Every time you send a text message to, a loved one, or change a calendar event, or even just upload a photo of your dog, you're technically asking a billionaire server for permission.
Yeah, which is kind of wild when you think about it.
Right. You might feel like you own your digital life, but the architectural reality of the internet is that you are basically just a tenant.
Exactly. You're renting your social graph from a massive corporation.
You're renting your document storage. You are, essentially a squatter in your own digital house. And the landlords can change the locks, they can alter the terms of service or scan your private life whenever they feel like it.
They absolutely can, and they do.
But today, we are looking at a protocol that is effectively evicting the landlords. We're looking at a system where the network is simply, well, us.
It's a pretty radical departure from everything we've normalized over the past 30 years. Like, we just accept the client-server model as the only way the internet can function.
Right, where you are the client and they are the server.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But from an engineering standpoint, it really doesn't have to be that way. We are moving toward a concrete reality where every single phone, laptop, and, smart device is treated identically as a peer.
So no central databases at all.
None. No cloud providers holding your identity hostage.
And that is our mission for you today on this deep dive. We are going to demystify the eThrive protocol.
That's a fascinating one.
We're going down to the absolute bedrock of this system, and we're going to build this mental model from the ground up. We'll explore exactly how two devices, maybe your phone and a friend's phone, pair in person.
Yeah, and how they bust through network firewalls to talk directly.
Right. We'll explore how always online relays, Bluetooth sensors, and even like a long-range LoRaWAN radios form a mesh that survives completely off the grid.
Which is huge.
And finally, we'll see how third-party apps can be invited into your digital space without ever stealing a single byte of your data.
When you truly grasp the mechanics of eThrive, I mean, it changes the geometry of the internet in your mind. You stop thinking about logging into accounts, you start thinking about cryptographic spaces and append-only logs.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can talk about connecting phones or, busting through routers, we need to completely erase our current definition of what a user actually is.
Absolutely.
Because as I was reading through the eThrive architecture documentation, I realized that looking for a traditional user account in the system is like looking for a steering wheel on a horse. It's just the wrong paradigm entirely.
It is. In traditional web development, if you sign up for a service, a software engineer has created a table in a database. You get assigned an ID, maybe row number 4002.
Right.
They store your email, they hash your password,
Right.
and that company owns that row. They are the ultimate authority on whether you even exist on their platform.
But in eThrive, there is no database table because there's no central database.
Exactly. Instead, the absolute atomic unit of the system is something called a principal.
So, what makes up a principal? Like, if I'm setting up eThrive for the first time on my phone, how does it establish who I am without asking for an email address?
It generates a cryptographic key pair locally on your device. That's it.
Just a key pair.
Yeah. A principal is simply anything that possesses a public key and the corresponding private key. To
Yeah.
visualize this, I mean, think of a physical mailbox on the street.
Okay.
The public key is the address painted on the side of the mailbox. Anyone in the world can see it, and anyone can drop a message inside.
Right, but the private key is the actual physical metal key you keep in your pocket.
You got it. Only you can unlock the mailbox, read what's inside, or, stamp a return address on an outgoing letter that definitively proves it came from you.
So my identity isn't a username like TechFan99. My identity is a long string of mathematical characters.
Precisely.
But I noticed the documentation mentions two specific types of cryptography being used here. There's ED25519 and something called SEC256K1.
Yes, SECP256K1.
Right. Why would the protocol need two different mathematical approaches to generating these keys?
Well, it comes down to utility and the broader ecosystem of the internet. The primary signature scheme, ED25519, is sort of the modern workhorse of cryptography.
Okay. Why is that one the primary?
Because it is incredibly fast for a computer to process. The keys are very compact, and it's perfect for running efficiently on mobile phones where, battery life and processing power really matter.
Makes sense.
So when you generate a standard identity in eThrive, it's almost certainly going to be an ED25519 key.
And what about the second one? The sex curve.
So SECP256K1 is a very specific elliptic curve that happens to be the exact same mathematics used by Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right. By natively supporting this specific curve, eThrive builds a bridge directly to the Web3 world. If you use this curve for your principal, you essentially have a latent Ethereum account built right into your eThrive identity.
Wait, really?
Yeah. You can take your eThrive public key, run it through a standard hashing function, and you immediately have an on-chain wallet address.
So even if I don't care about blockchain stuff at all, the protocol has basically left a door open for that kind of integration.
Exactly. It's incredibly forward-thinking.
But let's bring it back to the local device. So my phone has generated a public and private key. I am a principal ledger. But a key is just an identity, right? It's not a conversation. It's not a file folder. It doesn't actually hold data. How do we do something useful with it?
That requires the core building block of the entire eThrive architecture, which is the space. Everything in this protocol revolves around this concept.
A space.
Yeah, a space is a cryptographic append-only log of operations. We usually just call it an op log.
An append-only log.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I have this straight. It's like a shared document, maybe like a Google Doc, but the cursor is permanently locked at the very bottom.
That's a great way to put it.
I can type new sentences, but I literally cannot hit the backspace key to delete what I wrote yesterday. I can only add new information to the end.
That analogy holds up perfectly. And, well, here is the technical reason why. Every single entry, every op or operation that gets added to this log is cryptographically signed by the author's private key.
Okay.
If you're allowed to go back and alter a previous entry, the mathematical signature would break and the entire network would instantly reject the changes forged. So you can only append.
And here is the part of the documentation that genuinely broke my brain for a minute. A user, meaning you or me actually using the app, isn't a special class of object in the code.
Nope.
A user is literally just a space where the roster of members is exactly one.
Yes. The developers refer to this as your primary space. When you open an eThrive app and generate your key pair, creates a brand new space, and then adds your key pair as the sole member of that space's roster.
Oh, wow.
That space effectively becomes your identity and your personal database rolled into one.
Let's play this out for the listener. Imagine you get a new laptop. You want all your data on it. In the old world, you go to a website and log in with a password. In the eThrive world, what actually happens?
Well, you open the app on your new laptop, and it generates a completely new blank key pair. You don't log in.
Because there's nowhere to log into.
Right. Instead, you use your phone, which controls your primary space, to mathematically admit the laptop's public key as a second member of the roster.
Gotcha. So my primary space now has two members.
Exactly. The laptop is granted permission to sync the op log, it downloads the history, and now both devices have identical state and they're both controlled by you.
That is incredibly elegant. So whether we are talking about my private notes, a direct message between the two of us, or a massive group chat with 100 people, the underlying plumbing is entirely identical.
It is. It's always just a space.
And that space is always just an append-only log of ops. But let's zoom in on these operations. What exactly does one of these ops look like under the microscope?
Well, an operation is a tiny package of data that mutates the state of the space. If you think of the space as a flipbook, the op is a single page.
Oh, okay. I like that visual.
Every op contains a few mandatory fields. It must contain the author's public key, proving who wrote it. It contains a payload, which is the actual content, like the text of a chat message or a command to change your profile picture. And it contains a cryptographic signature validating the entire package.
I want to pause on that payload. Because the documentation was very specific about how that data is formatted before it gets signed.
Mm-hmm.
It mentions something called JCS.
Yes, the JSON canonicalization scheme.
Right. And I know JSON is just a standard way web applications format data, you know, using curly braces and quotation marks. But why does eThrive need a strict scheme for it? If I send a message, doesn't the data just speak for itself?
To understand why this is critical, we have to look at how fragile cryptographic signatures are, which is honestly exactly what makes them secure. A signature is generated by running the data through a mathematical algorithm. If you change a single bit of that data, even a microscopic change, the resulting signature will be completely different.
Okay, so if I try to tamper with the text of a message, the signature breaks. That makes sense.
But it goes further than that. Yeah. Let's say your phone packages a JSON object that says, name is Alice, age is 30. Your phone calculates the signature based on that exact byte sequence and sends it to my computer.
Okay.
But what if my computer software prefers to read JSON alphabetically? What if my computer loads it into memory as age is 30? Name is Alice.
Oh, to a human, that is the exact same information. Alice is 30.
Right. But to the cryptography, the word name is a completely different sequence of binary ones and zeros than the word age.
Yeah, of course.
So if my computer tries to verify your signature using the reordered data, the math will fail. The network will think the message is corrupted or hacked, and we'll just throw it away.
So the spaces, the line breaks, the order of the variables, if any of that shifts during transit, the signature is ruined.
Precisely why JCS, RFC 8785, is enforced. It guarantees that before any device signs a payload, and before any device verifies a payload, the JSON is translated into the exact same rigid sequence of bytes.
So no alphabetizing differently.
Nope. The keys are always in the same order. The Weismann rules are absolute. It ensures that a signature generated on an iPhone verifies flawlessly on a Linux server or, you know, a smart refrigerator.
That is a brilliant piece of standardization. Now, there is one more critical feel in the op that we haven't touched on, and it seems to be the engine that makes synchronization work, which is the Lamport counter.
Oh, the Lamport clock is one of the most elegant concepts in distributed systems.
How so?
Well, because we don't have a central server, we don't have a master clock. We can't rely on timestamps. Because your phone's clock might be 3 minutes ahead of my laptop's clock.
Right. Time zones alone make that messy.
Exactly. So how do we order events? We use a strictly increasing number maintained by each author.
So if I am in a space and I author my very first operation, my Lamport counter is one. When I send my next message, I look at the highest number I've ever seen in the space and I increment it. So my next message is two, then three, and so on.
Exactly. And the protocol combines your public key with that Lamport counter to create a globally unique ID for that operation. The op ID is just your author, public key, a colon, and the Lamport number.
Okay, I see.
Because nobody else possesses your private key, nobody else can author an op pretending to be you. And because your Lamport counter never goes backward, you will never generate the same ID twice.
The documentation points out that this structure provides idempotency, which is a heavy computer science term, but as I understand it, it means the network can be completely chaotic and it won't break the application.
That's a great way to summarize it.
Yeah.
In a peer-to-peer mesh, data doesn't travel in a straight line. Like if you, me, and a friend are in a group chat, you might send a message directly to my phone.
Right.
But our friend might also receive your message and their phone might automatically relay a copy of it to me just to be helpful.
So your phone receives the exact same operation twice from two different directions.
Right. And in a poorly designed system, my chat interface might show your message twice.
Which is super annoying.
Very. But because of idempotency, my eThrive node looks at the incoming data, sees the op ID of, say, Alice's key Lamport 5, and it checks its local storage. And it says, well, I already have Alice's op number 5.
And it just ignores it.
It silently drops the duplicate. The network can flood my device with 1,000 copies of the same message, and it will only ever process it once.
Okay, the mathematical logic here is beautiful. It's really resilient. But I have to throw a massive wrench into this.
Bring it on.
I'm trying to visualize using this protocol every day for years. If a space is strictly an append-only log, meaning we can only add to the bottom forever, won't my phone storage just hit a wall and completely explode?
That's a fair question.
I mean, imagine a group chat that's been active for 5 years. Imagine I update my profile picture 50 times over that period.
Mm.
Is every single person's phone in that chat storing all 50 of my old, outdated, high-resolution profile pictures forever?
Yeah, that is the most common critique of append-only systems. But eThrive solves it through a localized consensus mechanism called compaction.
Compaction.
Right. While the log is conceptually append-only, the underlying storage engine is intelligent enough to know when historical data has become mathematically irrelevant.
Wait, how does it know that if the ledger is sacred, how do you delete a page?
By using last writer wins, or LWW rules, combined with vector clocks. Let's stick with your profile picture example. You change your picture. That operation enters the log at Lamport 100.
Okay.
A year later, you get a new haircut, you take a new photo, and you author a new op to change it again. Let's say that's Lamport 500.
So now the log contains two completely different image files attached to my identity. Under last writer wins, my phone knows that Lamport 500 is higher than 100, so it displays the new picture in the user interface.
Exactly.
But the old picture is still sitting on my hard drive.
It is. And you cannot unilaterally delete it yet.
Why not?
Because you don't know the state of the rest of the network. What if one of the members of this space is a friend who has been on a submarine for 6 months? They are totally offline.
Right.
When they finally surface and connect, they need to sync the history. If you deleted Lamport 100 too early, their device would have a missing link in the chain of operations.
So the system is forced to hold on to my old picture just in case the submarine guy needs it. That still sounds like a storage nightmare.
But it doesn't hold it forever. Every time devices in a space connect, they share their vector clock, which is simply a report of the highest LAN port counter they've seen from every user.
Okay, so they're basically comparing notes.
Exactly. My phone tells your phone, hey, I am fully caught up. I've seen LAN port 500. Your phone tells Bob's phone, I've seen LAN port 500.
Ah, so there is a moment where the system realizes that literally every single member of the roster has acknowledged the new reality.
Yes. Once your local node can mathematically prove, based on these vector clocks, that every single authorized member of the space has received LAN port 500, it knows for an absolute certainty that LAN port 100 will never be requested again.
Wow.
At that precise microsecond, the old operation and its attached image file are completely purged from your local storage.
That is fascinating. The system cleans up its own garbage automatically, but only when it is cryptographically safe to do so.
Yep. It maintains the integrity of a decentralized network without turning everyone's phone into a massive data hoard.
Eventual consistency paired with eventual garbage collection.
Exactly. It allows the append-only paradigm to survive in the real world of limited hard drive space.
All right, we have our foundation. We understand public keys, we understand spaces, we understand the op log, and we know how compaction keeps our storage from filling up.
We got basics.
But right now, this is all just theoretical architecture floating in a white room. We need to look at how this software actually behaves in the hands of human beings.
Let's do it.
Imagine you and I are sitting at a table in a crowded coffee shop. We both have eThrive installed on our phones. We want to connect. Because there are no central servers, I can't just type in your username and let a cloud database introduce us.
Right.
Our physical phones have to find each other in the room and forge a secure link. How do we make first contact?
The protocol handles this through a pairing ceremony, and the most robust way to execute this in person is using QR codes. It perfectly bridges the physical world with the cryptographic world.
Let's walk through it from the perspective of the listener. You want to connect your phone to my device. The very first thing your phone does is generate an invite code.
Yes.
Now, this isn't just a basic web link. The structure of the data embedded in that QR code is incredibly specific.
It's a strictly formatted string that looks like this. eThrive colon, V1 colon, the space public key colon, a token colon, the reach payload.
Okay, let's break that down. eThrive V1 obviously tells the camera what protocol we are dealing with. And the space public key is the public key of the specific space you are being invited to. Like, if we are just starting a private chat, my phone generates a brand new key pair for a pair space, which is just for the two of us, and puts that public key in the code.
Exactly.
What about the token?
The token is a random 16-byte string generated by your device the moment you hit the invite button. You can kind of think of it as a single-use password.
Okay.
Its entire purpose is to prove that the device attempting to connect actually possesses the QR code you are displaying and isn't just some attacker randomly guessing public keys on the network.
Makes sense. And the final piece, the reach payload. That sounds like network routing.
That is the most complex part of the payload. The reach section is a base 64 all encoded package of connection information. It tells my phone exactly how to physically route data to your phone.
Like an IP address?
Sort of. In the eThrive ecosystem, this reach payload usually contains a compact WebRTC SDP offer.
Okay, WebRTC. I've used that term before when talking about browser-based video calls like Google Meet or Zoom. But we aren't making a video call here. We are sending text and data. Why use a video streaming protocol?
Because beneath the video and audio streaming capabilities, WebRTC contains something called data channels. And data channels are arguably the most powerful peer-to-peer networking tool widely available today.
Really? Why does eThrive lean so heavily on them?
A few reasons. First, they are universally supported. Every modern mobile phone, every web browser, and every desktop operating system has WebRTC built deep into the stack. You don't need to ask the user to install custom networking drivers.
Which is great for adoption.
Exactly.
And what about security? If we are sending raw data over the local coffee shop Wi-Fi, isn't it vulnerable to interception?
That is the second massive advantage of WebRTC data channels. They mandate end-to-end encryption out of the box using two protocols, DTLS and SRTP.
DTLS, what is that?
Datagram Transport Layer Security. It is effectively the same encryption that secures your banking website, but optimized for fast, connectionless data packets.
Okay.
And SRTP secures the real-time media flow. By packaging a WebRTC offer into the QR code, your phone is essentially saying, hey, here are the cryptographic parameters I require, and here are the network paths where I am listening.
So you hold up your phone, I scan the QR code of my camera. What happens in the milliseconds after my phone decodes that WebRTC offer?
Your phone reads the parameters, configures its own WebRTC stack, and fires a connection request directly to my phone's IP address on the local Wi-Fi.
Okay, so the raw networking pipe is established.
Right, but a pipe isn't enough. We need to verify each other cryptographically.
Hmm.
This triggers the admit ceremony.
How does that actually work without passing secrets in plain text?
Well, your phone, acting as the joiner, sends an admit begin frame over the new pipe. And included in this frame is a newly generated random number called a joiner nonce.
Okay, so my phone knocks on the door and hands you a random number.
Yes. Your phone receives it, verifies that I use the single-use token from the QR code, and then it generates its own random number, a host nonce.
Got it. So now both devices hold both numbers, my joiner nonce and your host nonce.
Exactly. And this is where the cryptography bridges back to the human beings holding the phones. Both devices take those two random numbers and run them through a cryptographic hashing algorithm.
Okay.
Because a hashing algorithm is entirely deterministic, meaning the exact same inputs always produce the exact same output. Both phones independently calculate the exact same four-digit PIN.
I want to make sure I understand the mechanics of this because it feels kind of like magic. The PIN is never actually transmitted over the Wi-Fi network, right?
Never. The numbers used to make the PIN are transmitted, but the PIN itself is calculated locally in the isolated memory of each phone.
And the result is that my screen suddenly displays a number, let's say 8472.
Right.
And your screen across the table also displays 8472. We look at our screens, we look at each other, and you say, are you seeing 8472? I nod, and we both tap the confirm button.
It is a profound security mechanism. By comparing those numbers out loud in the physical world, we completely eliminate the possibility of a man-in-the-middle attack.
Let's explore that attack. Suppose there is a hacker sitting in the corner of the coffee shop with a telephoto lens. They zoom in, snap a picture of my QR code, and their laptop furiously tries to initiate the connection before you do. What happens?
The hacker's laptop sends an admit begin frame with its own completely different joiner nonce. Your phone receives it, generates a host nonce, and calculates a PIN based on the hacker's input.
Yep.
So your phone will show a PIN on the screen, say 11138. But my phone, the one you are actually looking at, hasn't connected yet. Or if it has, it's connected to a different section and has generated a completely different PIN.
Oh.
When you look at me and say, do you see 1138? I will look confused and say, no, I don't even have a PIN yet.
We immediately realize the connection is compromised. We hit cancel and the hacker gets absolutely nothing.
Exactly. It uses human communication to authenticate the invisible mathematics.
That is brilliant. So we both see the same PIN. We both tap confirm. What is the final step that actually lets us chat?
Your device, acting as the host, authors a member.add operation. It generates a formal membership certificate for my public key, signs it, and appends it to the op log of the pair space.
It officially lets you in.
Right. It then streams that op log over the encrypted WebRTC channel to my phone. My phone reads the log, sees it has been officially admitted, and the connection is finalized. A new digital space has been born.
Okay, we are paired. We have a shared, encrypted, peer-to-peer data pipe. We send a few messages.
Smooth sailing.
But I have to bring us back to reality again because we skipped over a massive networking problem.
Uh-oh.
In our coffee shop example, we were on the same Wi-Fi network. Our phones could see each other's local IP addresses. But what if we leave the coffee shop? You go home to your apartment and your phone connects to your home Wi-Fi router. I go for a walk and my phone connects to a 5G cellular tower.
Right.
Neither of us has a public IP address anymore.
This is the bane of every peer-to-peer developer's existence. It's the reason the internet today is dominated by central servers. The problem is called network address translation, or NAT.
Let's give the listener some historical context here, because NAT wasn't supposed to exist, was it?
It really wasn't. When the internet was designed, the vision was that every single computer would have its own unique, globally accessible public IP address. Anyone could route packets directly to anyone else.
Sounds nice in theory.
But the architects used a 32-bit address space, known as IPv4, which only allowed for about 4.3 billion unique addresses.
Which is less than the population of the Earth.
Exactly. By the late 1990s, it became painfully obvious that we were going to run out of addresses before every human even got a computer, let alone multiple devices.
So as a desperate band-aid, engineers invented NAT. Instead of giving every laptop and smart plug in your house a public address, your internet service provider gives one single public IP address to your home router.
Right. And your router then creates a fake private network inside your house.
Right. It hands out private IP addresses like 192.168.1.5 to your phone, your laptop, your TV.
Exactly. When your phone wants to load a website, the router intercepts the request, rewrites the packet to look like it came from the router's public IP, sends it to the server, and when the server replies, the router translates it back and forwards it to your phone.
It is a brilliant hack that saved the internet from collapsing.
It is, but it completely destroys peer-to-peer communication.
Because if I am on cellular and I want to send an eThrive message to your phone sitting in your apartment, I have no idea where to aim the data.
Right.
I can't send it to your private 192.168 address because millions of other routers use that exact same fake address. And if I send it to your router's public IP, your router's firewall will look at the unsolicited incoming packet, say, I didn't ask for this, and instantly drop it into the void.
This is exactly why the eThrive architecture includes the ICE provider interface. IC stands for Interactive Connectivity Establishment. It is a framework designed specifically to break through these NAT firewalls.
How does IC actually punch a hole through the router?
IAE works by frantically gathering candidates, which are basically different disguises and pathways your phone can use to try and reach the outside world.
Okay.
The first candidate it tries is the host candidate, which is just your local private IP. As we saw in the coffee shop, if you are on the same local network, this works perfectly.
But since you are on 5G and I'm at home, the host candidate fails.
Exactly. So the local path is blocked.
What's the next tool in the ICE toolkit?
IE moves to STUN. STUN stands for Session Traversal Utilities for NAT. And its job is to produce a server reflexive candidate.
I love the concept of STUN. To help the listener visualize this, imagine you were standing inside your house, but every single window is painted completely black.
That's a great analogy.
You have no idea what the street looks like, and you don't even know what address is painted on your own curb. You can't tell anyone how to find you. So you pick up your phone and you call a friend who is standing outside on the sidewalk. You ask them, hey, what does my house look like from out there?
That is a perfect analogy for STUN. The STUN server is that friend on the outside. Your eThrive app sends a tiny harmless ping to a public STN server on the internet.
Okay.
The STUN server receives the ping, looks at the metadata, and replies, I see this packet coming from the public IP address 203.0.113.5, and it emerged from port number 4000.
So now my phone knows its public disguise. It knows how the router translated its private IP.
Yes. Your phone takes that public IP and port, and it somehow communicates that to my phone. We'll get to how it discovers that in a moment.
Right.
But here is the true magic of STUNR, a process known as UDP hole punching. When your phone sent that initial ping out to the STN server, your home router had to open a temporary gateway, a hole in the firewall, to let the response back in.
The router added an entry to its internal NAT table saying, I am expecting traffic back on port 4000.
Exactly. So my phone, sitting on the cellular network, takes the public IP and port you gave me, and it fires a WebRTC data packet directly at your router on port 4000.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Your router sees the incoming packet. Normally, it would block it, but because you just punched a hole from the inside, the router thinks my packet is the legitimate response it was waiting for.
It passes the packet right through the firewall and delivers it directly to your phone.
Exactly. We have successfully bypassed the billionaire's server. We are communicating peer-to-peer across the public internet, tricking our routers into letting the traffic through.
It's slightly hacky, but incredibly effective internet engineering.
It works in the vast majority of consumer home networks. But there are environments where it fails.
Like where?
Corporate firewalls, university networks, or routers configured with symmetric NAT. Symmetric NAT aggressively randomizes ports for every single outgoing connection. In these scenarios, the hole punching fails. Your router realizes my packet is an imposter and blocks it. We need a final fallback.
So if the STUN trick fails, we need TURN.
Yes. TURN stands for traversal, using relays around NAT. When direct connection is mathematically impossible, a TURN server is used to literally relay the encrypted bytes between the two peers.
Expanding on our analogy, if the street in front of your house is entirely blocked by a massive brick wall and I can't even see your house, TURN is like hiring a courier.
Okay, I like this.
I hand a locked heavy metal briefcase to the courier. The courier drives over the wall, finds your house, and hands the briefcase to you. You put a letter inside, lock it, and hand it back to the courier to bring to me.
Exactly.
The courier the TURN server, is handling the data. But because the WebRTC channel is encrypted end-to-end with DTLS, the courier has absolutely no idea what is inside the briefcase.
That is crucial to understand. Using a TURN relay does not compromise the security or privacy of the eThrive protocol. The server sees scrambled noise. And the elegance of eThrive's modular architecture is that this entire exhausting process, trying the LAN, pinging the Sun server, falling back to the TURN courier, happens completely invisibly in the transport layer.
The layers above it don't even know.
Right. The space layer above it doesn't care how the bytes move. It just hands an operation to the transport layer and says, get this to Alice.
Okay, so we've solved the physical routing problem. But there is a glaring logical gap here.
What's that?
In the coffee shop, we used a QR code to hand each other the WebRTC connection data. But if we are in different parts of the city and our IP addresses have changed because of NAT, how do we exchange that new connection data?
Oh, yes.
Obviously, I don't need to track you down and scan a QR code every time I want to text you. How do our devices find each other in the dark?
That is managed by the Discovery Interface and a background service called the Mesh Reconnect Orchestrator.
Okay, the orchestrator.
When we first paired, my phone saved your public key and our initial connection data in a local contact book. When you open the app the next day, the orchestrator wakes up, it looks at the contact book and says, I need to find Alice.
Does it just aggressively spam the network trying to find me?
No, that would drain your phone's battery in an hour. It uses an exponential backoff algorithm. It tries to connect using the last known good address.
Mm-hmm.
If that fails, it waits 5 seconds and tries again.
And if that fails?
It waits 10 seconds, then 20 seconds, eventually maxing out at a 5-minute interval. It persistently but gently probes the network.
But if my IP address has completely changed, the old address is dead. Where does it look for the new one?
eThrive uses several pluggable discovery mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the most localized one, MBNS. Or multicast DNS.
Right. MDNS is the same technology that allows my laptop to instantly find my wireless printer on my home Wi-Fi, or lets my phone cast a video to my smart TV without me typing in an IP address.
Exactly. It operates entirely on the local area network. When the orchestrator wakes up, it essentially shouts into the local network room, hey, I'm looking for the device with public key X. Are you here?
Okay.
If you happen to be on the same office Wi-Fi as me, your device hears the shout and replies directly. You discover each other without ever touching the public internet.
But if we were in different cities, MDNS won't work. A shout in my living room doesn't reach your apartment.
For global discovery, the protocol relies on a DHT, a distributed hash table.
Like BitTorrent.
Yes, exactly like BitTorrent. It is a massive, decentralized, global bulletin board maintained by thousands of nodes. When your phone gets its new public IP address from the Sun server, it encrypts that routing information and pins it to the DHT bulletin board under your public key.
So my phone asks the DHT, where is Alice? The DHT hands me your encrypted routing data. My phone decrypts it, finds your new Sun address, and initiates the WebRTC hole punch.
Exactly. The orchestrator finds you, the transport layer punches the hole, and the encrypted data channel snaps open.
This brings us to a critical moment in the protocol. The absolute millisecond that connection opens, how do our two devices figure out what they missed while they were disconnected?
Right, because things changed.
Yeah, I might have sent 5 messages while you were asleep and you might have renamed the chat room.
This is where we return to vector clocks. The instant the link is established, before any user data is sent, the two peers exchange a hello frame. This frame contains the vector clock for every space they share.
Let's visualize this calculation for the listener because it's the secret to why eThrive syncs so incredibly fast.
It really is.
Remember the LAN port counter, the number that ticks up every time someone authors an operation? A vector clock is just a map of those numbers. Let's say we share a space with a third friend, Charlie.
In the hello frame, my phone sends your phone a matrix that says, for my own key, the highest LAN port I have is a 120. For Alice, the highest I've seen is 50. For Charlie, the highest is 12.
My phone receives that matrix and compares it against its own local database. My phone says, wait a minute, for Alice, my own key, my LAN port is actually at 55 because I wrote 5 new messages while you were offline.
Right.
For Bob, I am at 120, so we match. And for Charlie, I'm at 12, so we match there too.
So, in a fraction of a millisecond, with zero ambiguity, and without pulling a central server to ask what's the latest version, your phone knows exactly what I am missing. I need your operations 51 through 55.
My phone packages those specific 5 ops into an OT batch frame, streams them over the WebRTC pipe, and we are perfectly synchronized.
Yep. It is remarkably efficient. It is the mathematical definition of causal consistency.
Okay, I love the mechanics of this, but I have to introduce a major pushback.
Let's hear it.
Let's look at a hypothetical scenario that breaks this entire paradigm. I write a message to you at 2 p.m. I hit send. Then I immediately turn my phone off and board a 12-hour international flight.
Okay.
At 4 p.m., you finish work, turn on your eThrive app and want to check your messages. The Mesh Reconnect orchestrator fires up. It checks the DHT. But my phone is completely powered off in an airplane overhead bin.
Right. It's totally dark.
It is not on the network. We are never online at the same time. In a pure peer-to-peer system, how does my message ever reach you?
This is the fundamental, inescapable challenge of purely asynchronous peer-to-peer networks. If both endpoints aren't active simultaneously, direct transmission is impossible.
So the message is just stuck.
Well, no. To solve this, eThrive extends the concept of the space to include infrastructure, creating the space's mailbox pattern.
Let's unpack that. If a space is just a roster of members managing an op log, does that mean I can add non-human devices to my primary space?
Yes. You don't just add your phone and your laptop. You can add headless devices.
Oh.
Imagine you buy a cheap mini PC or a Raspberry Pi.
Okay.
You plug it into the wall in your living room, connect it to your home Wi-Fi, and install the eThrive runtime. You use your phone to admit the Raspberry Pi's public key into your primary space. It is now a recognized, mathematically authorized extension of your identity.
Because it is a member of my primary space, the core rules of the protocol dictate that it must download and maintain the exact same append-only op log as my phone.
Correct. And here's the genius of the architecture.
Yeah.
Any member of a space can act on behalf of that space for synchronization purposes.
Wow.
Your home relay is always plugged in, always online, and has a highly stable IP address. It is constantly advertising its presence on the global DHT.
So let's replay the airplane scenario. At 2 p.m. before I get on the flight, I type my message to you. My phone looks for you. It can't reach your phone directly.
Yeah.
But it can reach your home Raspberry Pi relay because your relay is online and mathematically authorized to speak for you.
Exactly. Your phone does the HelloFrame exchange with my relay, realizes my relay is missing your new message, and syncs the op to my living room. Your phone can now safely turn off.
And then what happens when you wake up?
12 hours later, my phone wakes up. It can't find you, but it connects to my own relay. It compares vector clocks, downloads the message you wrote, and the asynchronous gap is successfully bridged.
And to be absolutely clear for the listener, this relay is not acting like a traditional cloud server.
Not at all.
It doesn't have administrative privileges over my account. It can't reset my password or read my data if I don't give it the decryption keys. It is just another peer in the mesh that happens to never sleep.
Exactly. It's a topological convenience, not a hierarchical authority. The protocol treats your phone and the relay as absolute equals.
This concept of adding specialized devices to a space leads us perfectly into one of the most fascinating layers of the eThrive architecture, which is transport pluggability.
Oh, this is where it gets really fun.
We've spent a lot of time talking about WebRTC, SD-owned servers, and internet routing. But what if there is no internet? What if I am totally off the grid?
This is where we look at the 13 pluggable interfaces defined in the eThrive specification. One of them is the transport interface.
Okay.
The core protocol is not married to WebRTC. WebRTC is just one way to fulfill the transport contract. You can write a custom transport for literally any medium that can move digital bytes from point A to point B.
So I could write a transport layer that uses Bluetooth. Or even LoRaWAN, the long-range, wide-area network radio protocol.
Yes, and this is where eThrive becomes incredibly powerful for mesh networking. You can have a device added to your space that has no Wi-Fi chip, no Ethernet port, and doesn't even know what an IP address is.
Seriously?
Yeah. It only communicates via sub-gigahertz LoRaWAN radio waves.
Let's build a scenario around this because it really highlights the resilience of the architecture. Imagine I am a hiker deep in a mountain valley. I am 50 miles away from the nearest cell tower.
Okay, totally offline.
But I have my phone, and clipped to my backpack is a small eThrive-enabled LoRaWAN radio node. I author a message to you, found a great campsite, coordinates attached, I hit send. What happens physically?
Your phone authors the operation, signs it, and appends it to your local log. It looks for peers. The only peer it can find is the LoRaWAN node on your backpack, connected via local Bluetooth.
Okay, so it hands the op to the backpack node.
Right. It syncs the op to the radio node.
Yeah.
Now, LoRaWAN is a fascinating protocol. It trades bandwidth for range. It can only send tiny amounts of data, but those radio waves can travel for miles across open terrain.
Because an eThrive operation is just a tiny, highly compressed JSON payload, it fits perfectly within those constraints.
Right. Your backpack node broadcasts the operation across the valley using radio frequency. 10 miles away, at a ranger station, there's another LoRaWAN node listening.
Just passively listening.
Yes. It catches the radio wave, decodes the bytes, and appends the operation to its local log. Later that day, a friend of yours hikes past the ranger station. Their phone connects to the station's node via Bluetooth, exchanges vector clocks, and syncs the operation.
So my message is literally moving physically through the environment. It went from my phone, over Bluetooth, to my backpack, over LoRaWAN across a valley to a ranger station, and over Bluetooth again to my friend's pocket. It's like a digital baton relay.
And here is the critical piece. Throughout that entire chaotic journey across multiple different physical transport layers, the cryptographic integrity of your message is perfectly maintained.
Why is that?
Because the operation was signed by your Route 255 Wanintang key pair. None of the intermediate radios or phones could alter the text of your message without breaking the signature. They're just blind couriers carrying a sealed envelope.
And the final step. 2 days later, my friend drives out of the mountains and back into the city. Their phone connects to a 5G cell tower. The Mesh Reconnect Orchestrator wakes up, finds your home Raspberry Pi relay on the internet via the DHT, punches a hole via WebRTC Sun, and syncs my message to your cloud relay.
Beautiful.
You open your app and read my message. The op traveled over radio waves in the wilderness, sat dormant in a pocket, and blasted over fiber optic lines to your living room.
And the space layer, the part of the code that understands the chat message, didn't have to change a single line of logic. It decoupled the movement of the bytes from the meaning of the bytes.
It is a stunning achievement in network engineering. We have phones, Raspberry Pis, Bluetooth beacons, and long-range radios all speaking the exact same mathematical language, passing this append-only log around the world. We have thoroughly solved the networking layer.
I'd say so.
But this brings me to a massive question regarding user experience. If I am using eThrive, I am not just typing raw JSON into a terminal to chat with you. I want to use rich applications. I want a beautiful calendar app, a powerful task manager, a fitness tracker that charts my heart rate. In the traditional software as a service model, if I install a fitness app, I am surrendering my health data to that company's cloud database. They own it, they monetize it.
Yeah, that's the standard model.
If eThrive is entirely about me owning my data inside my space, how do third-party apps function? Does the app developer get to see everything in my primary space?
This is where eThrive completely flips the power dynamic of the software industry on its head. It achieves this through the APP module. In this ecosystem, a third-party application is treated as a non-human principle.
A non-human principle. So when you download and install an app, your device generates a fresh, unique key pair specifically for that application.
Exactly. So the app itself has a public and private key, just like you do. It has an identity.
Okay.
And because it is a separate principle, it has zero access to your data by default.
Okay.
When you open the app for the first time, it has to initiate a consent ceremony. It presents a cryptographically signed manifest to your primary space.
This sounds a bit like the permissions prompt on my smartphone when an app asks to use my location. But what is actually happening mathematically when I click approve?
When you approve, your primary space authors a very specific operation called an app.grant. This operation generates a delegation certificate.
A delegation certificate. How does this differ from the OAuth tokens we use on the web today?
To understand the difference, let's look at the app container concept. When you grant this certificate, the system carves out a special dedicated subspace just for this application. The app's public key is placed into this container as the sole member.
Okay.
But, and this is the absolute crux of the model, your primary space is designated as the administrator of that container.
Let me try to build an analogy to visualize this. Installing a traditional web app is like hiring a private chef, but having to go to their restaurant to eat. You sit at their table, you eat their food, and when you leave, the leftovers stay in their refrigerator.
Right. They control the environment completely.
If they shut down the restaurant, your food is gone.
That is the perfect description of cloud vendor lock-in.
But in the eThrive model, the app container is like bringing the chef into your personal kitchen. You grant them a delegation certificate, which is like giving them a temporary electronic badge.
Yes.
But the badge only unlocks the refrigerator drawer labeled vegetables. The chef cannot open your personal safe. They cannot read your mail. They cannot see your chat logs. They cook the meal in your kitchen using your pots and pans. And the data they generate, the meal, stays in your house.
That analogy is incredibly accurate. The app stores its state using a specific scope, like app.container, which lives entirely within your storage infrastructure.
So it's physically on my device or my relay.
Exactly. And the access is violently restricted through selective disclosure.
Yeah.
The app doesn't ask for generic read profile access and harvest your name, email, and location. It asks for profile.read.name.
It gets the exact bytes it needs to function and nothing else.
Right. And the cryptographic rules of the op log mathematically prevent it from seeing a single bit of data outside that scope.
Because the data lives in my space, this opens up a feature that I find mind-blowing. Cross-app sharing. Let's say I install two different calendar applications.
Okay.
One is optimized for my heavy work schedule, and the other is a beautiful, simple calendar for my personal life. I want both apps to see my doctor's appointment. How does that work without building a complex API bridge between the two companies?
It works because there is no API bridge required. You grant both apps, db.read and db.write, access to the exact same calendar events table within your space.
So they are literally looking at the same append-only log.
Instantly. When the work calendar app writes a new event, it authors a db.put operation. That op goes into your log. The personal calendar app, which is monitoring that exact same log, sees the new op appear milliseconds later, processes it, and immediately updates its user interface.
There is no export a CSV button. There is no waiting for servers to sync.
No. The apps become completely interchangeable lenses through which you view your own canonical data. App developers are forced to compete purely on the quality of their user interface and their features because they can no longer hold your data hostage to prevent you from switching to a competitor.
That is a total paradigm shift for software business models.
It really is.
But let's go back to firing the chef. If I decide a fitness app is acting maliciously or I just don't want to use it anymore, I hit delete. In the old web, I click revoke access, and I just have to blindly trust that the company actually deleted my token from their backend servers.
Which you can never really prove.
Right. How does eThrive ensure the app is mathematically locked out?
In eThrive, trust is replaced by cryptographic proof through offline verifiable revocation. When you delete the app, your runtime authors an app.revoke operation. This op references the app's original delegation certificate and bumps a revocation version counter.
Because it's an operation, it gets appended to the log and it starts propagating across the mesh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the moment that revocation op reaches a peer, whether it's your home relay, your friend's phone, or a LoRaWAN node in the woods, that peer updates its state.
Okay, so the word spreads.
Right. If the revoked app tries to act maliciously, authors a new off and sends it to the network, every peer checks the signature. They see the op is signed by the app's key, they check the certificate, and they see that their local log has a higher revocation version than the app possesses.
And what do they do? Do they ask a server what to do?
No. They simply drop the packet. They reject the operation entirely. There's no central oath server to phone home to. Every device on the network makes an independent, mathematically sound decision to block the app based solely on the synced op log.
Wow.
The network acts like an immune system, neutralizing the revoked app instantly, even if you are entirely offline when the app tries to strike.
That is incredibly robust. Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground. We've zoomed in on the microscopic details of vector clocks, WebRTC hole punching, app containers. Let's zoom out to the stratosphere.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the grand architecture of eThrive. How is this entire machine organized so that it doesn't collapse under its own complexity?
The architecture is structured into five strict layers, decoupled by 13 pluggable interfaces. Layer one is the crypto and canonical encoding layer.
Okay.
This is the absolute bedrock, the ED25519 signatures, the hashing algorithms, the RFC 8785 JSON canonicalization. It has no concept of networks or state. It is just pure, verifiable math.
Layer two is the op log layer. This is where the append-only history lives. It handles the LAN port counters, the vector clocks, and the compaction rules that keep storage from exploding.
Layer three is the P2P transport layer. We spent a lot of time here. This is the WebRTC data channels, the stun turn traversal, the Bluetooth radios, and the LoRaWAN meshes. Its singular job is moving bytes across hostile environments.
And layer four?
Layer four is the space runtime. This is the intelligence. It takes the raw operations from layer two and projects them into meaningful state, like rosters, profiles, and database tables. And finally, layer five is the application layer where the user interfaces reside.
And the brilliance of the 13 pluggable interfaces is that you can swap out the components without breaking the network. The core protocol doesn't mandate how a device stores the op log. It just defines the op log store interface.
Exactly. On an iPhone, the op log store is likely backed by a highly optimized SQLite database. But if you deploy an eThrive relay on a massive enterprise server, that interface might be backed by a distributed Postgres cluster.
That flexibility is huge.
Because the interfaces are decoupled, a mobile phone running Squalite and talking over WebRTC can seamlessly synchronize with a cloud server running Postgres and talking over WebSockets. They don't care about each other's tech stack. They only care about the universal wire format, which is the signed operations.
The wire format is stable. By separating the movement of the data from the meaning of the data, the protocol future-proofs itself. And I think this is most evident in the handler contract, specifically the apply-up function.
Yes.
I want to clarify this for the listener because it solves one of the hardest problems in networking, the upgrade problem.
It really does.
Suppose I build a completely new kind of decentralized application on eThrive tomorrow. Let's say it's a decentralized real-time chess game. The core eThrive protocol has absolutely no idea what a chess move is. It only understands basic operations like member.add or app.grant.
Right.
Does the entire global eThrive network need a software update so my chess app can function?
Not at all. Your chess application defines a custom handler. It claims a new operation category. Let's call it a chess.move. When you move your knight, your app authors a chess.move up. It goes into your log.
Okay.
The transport layer sees it, doesn't understand it, but verifies the signature and syncs it. The oplog layer on the receiving peer sees it, persists it to disk, but does nothing with it.
So the network safely stores and routes operations it doesn't even understand.
Precisely. If I don't have your chess app installed on my phone still syncs your moves, helping to relay the data and keep the mesh resilient.
And what if you decide to play?
If I decide to install the chess app a week later, the app registers its handler with my runtime. The system scans my local log, finds all those historical chess.move operations, and runs them through the newly installed apply-op function. Instantly, the current state of the chessboard materializes on my screen.
It allows the protocol to evolve infinitely without ever breaking backward compatibility. The network acts as a universal carrier wave, and the applications simply tune in to decipher the meaning.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
We have been on an incredible journey today. We started with the humble public key, a string of mathematics that redefines identity. We put you in a coffee shop scanning a QR code to derive a secret PN via deterministic hashing, establishing an ironclad WebRTC connection.
We covered a lot of ground.
We watched as your phone pinged SDN servers to punch holes through home routers. And we marveled at how vector clocks calculate the exact missing pieces of a conversation in milliseconds.
We followed operations as they traversed wild hybrid networks, hopping from a hiker's LoRaWAN radio across a mountain valley to a Bluetooth beacon and eventually finding a stable, always online Raspberry Pi relay.
And finally, we saw how you can invite third-party applications into your digital home, granting them scoped field granular access that you can revoke with mathematically guaranteed finality.
It is a breathtaking vision of what software could be.
But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. As we discussed at the beginning, we are entirely used to renting our digital lives. We surrender our data to massive corporate silos because for the last 30 years, it was the only viable way to experience the internet. It was the cost of entry.
But if a protocol like eThrive succeeds, if it makes data portable, cryptographically secure, and locally owned by default, it poses an existential threat to the business models of modern tech giants.
What happens to a trillion-dollar company when they can no longer hold your social graph hostage? What kind of software will independent developers build when the database belongs entirely to the user, and applications are forced to compete strictly on the beauty of their interface and the utility of their tools?
It's a question that could entirely redefine the next era of human communication.
To the learner listening right now, keep exploring these concepts. The transition from renting your digital life to owning the bricks and the land yourself is going to be a wild, disruptive ride. Stay curious, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.